Welcome to the show. Thanks for watching. This is Daniel Workman coming to you from the Dreamaginate Sports Studios. Today you're watching a throwback edition of the show. This is a rewind to a past episode and interview. Thanks for watching. And now, without further ado, here is today's show. It's Independence Day, and coming up in a few minutes, we are going to have our guest Brian Costin joining us today to talk about transparency, governance. I don't think we could talk about better subjects than those on this day for American soccer. Look forward to chatting with him here in just a few minutes, but yesterday's second semifinal in the Women's World Cup took place between the Netherlands and Denmark, and it was a back-and-forth affair, both teams close throughout regulation. I mean, back-and-forth, near makes, close misses, no one scored, goes to extra time, and in the first half of extra time, the Netherlands were able to have a nice sequence of combination play right up the middle with a late run by one of their midfielders making an excellent shot far post, just beating the keeper. And the Netherlands hold on to win 1-0 for the victory to get the Netherlands into their first ever World Cup final. On the women's side, this is a team that has not only been undefeated at this World Cup, but this run of undefeated matches in tournament play going back into the women's Euros in 2017 is amazing. I mean, they have continued to win and move on. When I was looking at these teams early in the tournament, they were one of my dark horses to get here. I liked the way they were playing yesterday. Both teams were not at their brightest and best in terms of execution, but they both had chances. They both had moments. The Netherlands to beat the U.S. on Sunday, and we'll get more into this tomorrow, but in order for the U.S. to beat the Netherlands to beat the U.S. on Sunday, they are going to have to play a flawless match. They can do it, but they're going to have to be flawless. It's going to be a tough task for them with the amount of talent on this U.S. women's national team side. They are just so deep. So strong, so we'll see how that goes, and we'll talk about a little bit more about that tomorrow. But it was a intense affair yesterday, back and forth. Netherlands able to secure that victory late in the first half of extra time, 1-0, moving on to their first ever final. And you know, in terms of stadium ambiance, it'll be nice. You're going to see a big wave of orange in the stands, along with a lot of red, white, and blue. And I think Sunday's match is going to be a really good match. I do think at this point, looking at things, the U.S. heavy favorites to win, and rightly so. The U.S. men's national team took about three and a half hours to play their match last night, and no, it's not because it went into extra time and penalties and, you know, 40 rounds of penalties. It was a weather delay. They played 15 minutes or so and had to break for about 90 minutes due to bad weather in the Nashville area. Came back and were a little sloppy. They started the game against Jamaica in the Gold Cup, pretty fast, and were getting some chances. Converted one. They were up 1-0 before that break, 90 minutes, waiting on the weather. They come out and finally get restarted. And we're a little sloppy, but we're able to get a second goal. And after they got the second goal, Jamaica really kind of took over the game for a little bit of a stretch. We're able to get a goal, had a few other chances, unable to convert, and then Christian Pulisic scored his third of the night. He had the game winner and the second and third of the match, and that kind of sealed it at that point. U.S. men's winning last night 3-1 in Nashville against Jamaica, knocking them out, setting up a USA-Mexico Gold Cup final, which is the way that CONCACAF and U.S. Soccer and the Mexican Federation try to draw up these tournaments every time. So here we are again, USA, Mexico in the final. You know, watching the U.S. men's national team last night and listening to some of the comments from Stu Holden about as this tournament's gone on and watching Mexico play, you know, he feels like the U.S. is growing into this tournament and Mexico is have not, you know, been doing well as of late. And you know, feels like these two teams are going to be pretty evenly matched. I don't see it. I think Mexico are heavy favorites on Sunday, and I think the U.S. is facing a massive uphill climb against Mexico, and you know, it's just two levels to me the way these two teams are playing and the way that they're set up. So you know, that's Sunday. Following later in the day, following what takes place that morning, which is the World Cup final, U.S. women's national team and the Netherlands women's national team. So we have U.S. Holland in the morning and USA Mexico at night. Sunday, you'll have no shortage of soccer to tune into and set your schedules around, as both finals take place on the same day to book in the morning and the evening, and it will be it'll be a full day. I think if looking at everything today, I mean, tomorrow I'll make final predictions, but I think just at first glance, I think we look good in the morning, and I don't think we look so hot in the evening. But we'll get into those matchups more tomorrow on tomorrow's show. Other news that has come out, Romania are now with their football association are now looking to mandate that their top level clubs all field women's teams going forward. That is a trend that is happening around the globe as more and more countries are starting to take the women's game serious, start to invest, start to put in resources. There is an owner there that doesn't want to see this happen. But I think the way that the movement is taking place around the globe, I don't see him being able to keep that from happening going forward, because women's soccer is growing and the support is growing, and you're seeing countries like the Netherlands on the rise, Spain, Italy on the rise. You see the English women's national team, who, you know, just didn't execute in a few moments, didn't, you know, handle things, you know, in a few specific areas, the way that they had been handling them in the tournament, just made a few mistakes and it cost them. But they are a team that's on the rise. And so countries like the U.S., who have traditionally been powerhouses in the women's game, are going to have to get better at what we do in order to stay at the top. And part of that is we've got to get more resources into our women's game on the domestic side. The NWSL, there's no excuse or reason for the NWSL to only have 9 teams in America. That's ridiculous. We should have a league that's got, you know, at least, 15, 16, 18, 20 teams in our first division. We have plenty of resources. We know we have enough players. And it's time that the Federation unleashes the women's game in America. And by unleashing it, I mean putting resources in, allowing ownership groups to come in and build a system that is merit-based, allow any city in the country to embrace the women's game, and allow the markets to decide. If Dallas loves women's soccer, or San Antonio, or New Orleans, or Pittsburgh, and they want to pour their resources in, and they're good, and they do a good job, we should let them proceed on their own merit. Every club on the men's and women's side should have that opportunity, but in order for us to grow the women's game, we've got to open it up to the country. We've got to allow people to get creative and innovative. We need to think of the American soccer economy as this grand soccer experiment where it's a lab of innovation and creativity, where ownership groups and clubs can come up with ways to become sustainable, viable, beyond this archaic an arbitrary set of rules, the professional league standards that are in place now. Allow a club like Chattanooga to go to the public and offer ownership shares in the club to raise equity and capital. Allow clubs to basically take what has been the burden of one person and split that and share that between 5, 6, 8, 10, 12, 50 people. Allow a Bundesliga-style ownership to take place with a club where most of the club is owned by supporters and not by one individual. We need to open up American soccer to being a lab of innovation. When we do that, we could see women's soccer just blow up all over this country in places that maybe we didn't even think would embrace professionalism and the women's game. But we're never going to know when we just allow arbitrary rules to dictate arbitrary decisions, and thus we're left with only 9 teams in the NWSL. So I hope that changes. And I think we need to support the women's game here in this country. We need to do more. Our ladies are showing that they are top class, global standard as players. We have talent. We need to create an environment that is even better and is better compensated. And that's going to come through more competition. More competition breeds excellence. And we need more excellence to continue to stay at the top going forward. So that's my hope on this 4th of July. And I'm excited that this Sunday is coming up. It's going to be a great showcase for our women's team against the Netherlands. And heavy favorites. We'll break the game down tomorrow, but excited to see this matchup on Sunday. Our sponsor this half hour is Ductic Brand. You can learn more about Ductic at DUKTIGBrand.com. Use promo code DWSHOW and you will get 10% off your order. Great journals, great notebooks for coaches, players, goalkeepers, etc. Check them out, DuckTickBrand.com. We will be right back with Brian Costin right after this. Welcome back into the show. Thanks for tuning in this Thursday morning, July the 4th. It's Independence Day, and we couldn't have picked a better guest to be on this July 4th. We have Brian Costin joining us today. He is a nonprofit and governance expert with 10 years of nonprofit work and 4 years working in government and anti-corruption. Brian, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on this morning. How are you?
Great, Daniel. Happy Independence Day to you as well. And thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on. You have such a deep level of experience and knowledge about nonprofit work, governance, etc. And you know, for the viewing audience, if you are unaware, our soccer in this country is actually governed by a nonprofit called the United States Soccer Federation, and they are mired in multiple lawsuits and legal actions. And in my view, that's precisely due to poor leadership and governance. And so I wanted to kind of bring you on today to have a conversation about some things that that you see in the landscape of soccer and specifically in American soccer. And one of the first things I wanted to kind of talk to you about or pick your brain about is transparency. Why is transparency important when it comes to being a national governing body? And how is it helpful when you are a transparent organization?
Well, I think you kind of hit right on it. But first, a little bit about my background is that I'm from Illinois. And if you followed the news, you might have heard that Illinois has a little bit of a corruption problem, much like FIFA and other organizations within the soccer world have had corruption problems. And so from that experience, I've learned a number of lessons about, well, how do you proactively try to deal with that situation and shine a light on activity so that, number one, corruption is deterred from happening in the first place. But number two, also so that you can let your folks know that you are doing the right thing and you regain the trust of the soccer-loving public in America. Now, when it comes to both FIFA and U.S. soccer, I would say there's a long road in front of them to getting much, much better when it comes to transparency. When it comes to U.S. soccer, the biggest thing that I would look at where there's a lack of transparency is the Soccer United marketing deal. This was a deal from 2004 all the way through 2022 when the current deal expires. There hasn't been transparency. There hasn't been open competitive bidding. There hasn't been a forthright. There's been conflicts of interest that have been going on with the boards. Like, you have members from Soccer United Marketing on the board of U.S. Soccer and lots of people that work within the organization that were either employed before with Soccer United Marketing or might be in line for employment for them again in the future. So we want there to be trust and openness and following of the rules in U.S. soccer and FIFA. And that's why we should have a proactive transparency agenda for reform at that organization.
So when looking at some specifics with U.S. soccer, you brought up Soccer United Marketing and you brought up some of the board members. What do you know of the conflicts of interest specifically on the board? And are you aware of the policies that basically are exempting themselves from being considered conflicts of interest?
Right. So there is a conflicts of interest policy for specifically when they're negotiating the deal between Soccer United Marketing and Don Garber, who is a board member and also the president of CEO of Soccer United Marketing. is excused from the room when they are negotiating that deal. But, you know, there are a lot of decisions other than the contract that have a great amount of influence on soccer in America. And so one of the things that, that I would propose is, well, first of all, like, we don't know how much money Soccer United Marketing makes from the joint TV deal and how much U.S. Soccer makes from the joint TV deal. So, for example, the current contract that they're under right now, $90 million a year from ESPN, Fox Sports, and Univision goes to Soccer United Marketing. How much of that money comes to U.S. Soccer, because there are a lot of U.S. soccer games that are televised as part of that contract? No one really knows. I have asked U.S. Soccer specifically, what is that number? They have refused to disclose it. Another thing is, along with TV, Soccer United Marketing also handles all of the sponsorships for U.S. Soccer. So a couple months ago, you might have heard the announcement that Volkswagen is the presenting partner of U.S. Soccer. It's understood that Soccer United Marketing helps broker that deal. How much money does U.S. Soccer get from that? How much does Soccer United Marketing get from that? No one really knows. And the reason why that's such a big conflict of interest is because U.S. Soccer isn't following global standards in regards to having an open system, having a sporting merit system with promotion and relegation, where it'd be one thing with the Premier League and the Premier League having TV contracts and a lot of money coming in, but any team within the United Kingdom, within England, can rise up to the highest level and achieve those television dollars that come along with it. So it makes it especially troubling in the United States to have a secretive contract with a lack of competitive bidding and a lack of openness because of the way that we're structured in the United States. So there needs to be, if there was one change that I can make in U.S. soccer, is that I would divorce Soccer United Marketing and U.S. soccer, starting with the television deal. Have U.S. soccer be entirely on its own when it came to that. And if they wanted to set up their own open system with promotion and relegation, then sharing that revenues with teams from all across America would be fine. But we're far ways away from that. And that's probably the number one issue in U.S. soccer right now.
So you speak of, and you have a deep level of experience concerning transparency and transparency policies within a nonprofit organization. What are some specific transparency policies that we should be seeing within U.S. soccer?
Well, specifically, contracts. The contracts between U.S. Soccer and Soccer United Marketing, that should be completely online for everyone to see, down to the cent, every dime, online, in real time, is kind of the slogan. That should be a no-brainer. Let's just assume for a second that Soccer United Marketing isn't doing anything wrong in its relationship with U.S. Soccer. Let's just hypothetically. They would garner a lot of trust and a lot of confidence if they were just more proactively transparent about the way they did business and how much is going across the table both ways. That would be huge. Bidding is another very important transparency measure. Having an open and competitive bidding process where different folks from all different types of companies can come in and bid on the contract. A couple of years ago, there was a $4 billion offer from MP and Silva that talked about the broadcasting rights for Major League Soccer and U.S. Soccer. The reason why they had to come in and make this like huge splash of, wow, we're going to have this $4 billion deal, which is like four times as much as U.S. Soccer's ever had before, was because they're not actually allowed to be a part of the bidding process. There is no bidding process. So when the contract comes down to its final year in 2022, there's kind of an exclusive negotiating period where only Soccer United Marketing can negotiate with U.S. Soccer. So that leaves out everyone else in the United States or even globally that might want to invest in U.S. Soccer or propose a new system, which includes promotion and relegation, like MP and Silva, what they proposed. So that's another huge issue within U.S. Soccer that I see. But compensation, we have this huge compensation issue going on in the public sphere right now when it comes to women's soccer versus men's soccer, and how much the women's team, which in my personal opinion, I think that the women's team and the women's players should be getting paid more than the men's team. There's an economic case. And when you talk about a nonprofit and fulfilling the mission of the organization, women's soccer and the women's national team, they are the most important women's sports team in the entire world, from performance, from reach, from probably financial as well, but we don't have that detail from U.S. Soccer to be able to tell that. They are an unbelievable asset towards the mission of U.S. Soccer. So that's another huge, huge portion of transparency. And so that's just a sample of some of the transparency guidelines that I've put together for government organizations, for nonprofit organizations that act like a governance organization. It's really important if U.S. Soccer, which is mired in a litany of lawsuits right now that's costing the federation tremendous sums of money and legal fees, are you going to repair that image and repair that trust with the public, which it has lost, which has led to these lawsuits? Transparency is a very important first step to repairing the image of U.S. Soccer and ensuring that U.S. Soccer going forward is acting in an ethical and appropriate manner.
What do you know in terms of transparency and governance with U.S. Soccer? What do you know of the governance issues surrounding elections? And
comes down to there's some big issues with that as well. Who gets the vote, and how much share of the vote do they have? That's the biggest question that I have. And so, if you look at the mission of the organization, which is to promote and govern soccer in the United States in order to make it the preeminent sport recognized for excellence in participation, spectator appeal, international competitions, and gender equality. That's their mission. When you look at the voting population, well, let's go to that last term, gender equality. You don't see that anywhere within the voting rights of the organization. Specifically, if you're looking at the professional council and the split up, you know, Major League Soccer, I don't have the shares in front of me, but they have by far and away the largest share of that, the pro council votes, where the women have a very small share of that council. So that is a huge issue. You talk about, and you have the Hope Solo lawsuit, which is specifically looking at that in regards to federal law and if U.S. Soccer is following federal law. I think that Hope Solo has already had some success in court, and it ultimately might change the way that breakdown is done within U.S. Soccer. I hope that she's successful in that endeavor, because there are inequalities and there are questions about who has the control and power in U.S. Soccer, and is it appropriate, especially considering some of these other things about who they choose to do business with. If Soccer United Marketing and Major League Soccer have some of the most control and influence over the voting population, is it appropriate for them to also get the biggest contracts within U.S. Soccer? I think that's a huge question. And Another area where I think that there should probably be a divorce, at least on one side or the other, they shouldn't be able to both get huge contracts from U.S. soccer, but then have huge influence over who is going to be the leadership of U.S. soccer. It probably should be one or the other, that needs to change.
I agree completely, and that to me is one area where I think a lot of people don't realize just how much power and influence Don Garber and Major League Soccer have over the U.S. Soccer Federation through the voting, through the board seat, through the contracts. There is a stranglehold on the U.S. Soccer Federation, and that stranglehold has been allowed, quite honestly, by the leadership of U.S. Soccer. You know, it didn't start with Sunil Gulati, but he was definitely a big player in that in the beginning, and his presidency, much of that time was actually on the payroll of Bob Kraft, one of the primary, you know, Major League Soccer owners and operators. And so I think a lot of people don't, you know, put two and two together or haven't put two and two together and realized just how much that has an effect on things like the broadcast contracts, decisions that are made by U.S. Soccer, how leaders are elected within U.S. Soccer. And we ran into this quite honestly with the 2018 presidential election running Eric Winalda's campaign. You know, going into it, we all thought, man, we have a really good chance at this. And the closer we got to the election, the more we realized that this thing was jerry-rigged for the status quo to always come out on top. And when you have an athlete council that is in cahoots with Don Garber and Soccer United Marketing, it makes it very difficult to overturn or change the leadership at the top when you have that kind of almost a Soviet style voting block that are just, you know, basically a firewall against change within the Federation, which, you know, is just part and parcel of kind of the way things have been done for far too long. One of the recent announcements that came out in the last few months, and I was at the 2019 U.S. Soccer AGM in Phoenix when they had a breakout session on this, and I attended the breakout session to look at a U.S. Open Cup TV deal. What have you learned about the TV deal that U.S. Soccer announced concerning the U.S. Open Cup?
Sure. And so this is something that was announced earlier this year to the public. It is a deal that apparently goes through 2022 in regards to the Open Cup with ESPN, and most of the matches will be broadcasted on ESPN Plus. So I had a conversation about that. I wanted to know with U.S. Soccer about how that came about, what were the details about it, because in the press release, I saw that it was a deal that was brokered by Soccer United Marketing, and obviously that invites a lot of questions. And so initially, in the phone interview I had with U.S. Soccer, they said it was a part of the original broadcast deal that went from 2014 to 2022. In follow-up email, U.S. Soccer said that it is, in fact, not a part of that original TV deal. So I asked some additional follow-up questions about that, and I wanted to know, for example, when was the deal agreed upon? U.S. Soccer did not respond to a question about when the deal was agreed upon. They did not respond to a question about when Soccer United Marketing acquired the rights to the tournament. U.S. Soccer did not respond to a question if other vendors were interested in the U.S. Open Cup television contract or if the television contract was openly bid. And they did not respond to a question about whether the board was consulted about the approval of the contract. You know, back in the game, Carlos Cordero said that the unique ownership of some creates conflicts that needed to be addressed. And he pledged that the board and U.S. Soccer would act in a more open and transparent manner when it came to things such as new television deals, which is one of the biggest questions that there is in U.S. Soccer. And so right now, there is tremendous amount of uncertainty for me, and I think that the public should be tremendously uncertain about the future as well, as where is the leadership of U.S. Soccer going to be on this? Has this contract been awarded in an inappropriate manner? Is it a market deal? Who is receiving the benefits from it? So if some negotiated a deal with ESPN, is ESPN paying some? Is ESPN paying U.S. Soccer? Are there new additional revenues that are coming into the tournament that might be able to do things such as raise the award money or raise the money that's given out to the various amateur teams from all across the country to travel and stay in hotels and participate in the tournament and make it a richer tournament? I also asked questions about if there are plans in the future to have a U.S. Open Cup for women. They declined to answer all of these questions, and it really makes me worried, especially going into 2022, if U.S. Soccer is going to have a divorce from Soccer United Marketing, or at least a competitive, openly bid contract in the future that anyone can try to win that contract. I'm beginning to believe that Carlos Cordero, at least from the actions of U.S. Soccer and not answering these basic questions, he is starting to not deliver on the promises that he made during his president candidacy. We need more openness. We need more transparency. We need to, in the most important contracts and the most important relationship that has the most potential for the conflict of interest within U.S. Soccer, needs to be hyper transparent. And from what I'm seeing, we're getting the exact opposite and more of the same when it comes to the relationship between U.S. Soccer and Soccer United Marketing.
And just for the audience, I just want to say that Soccer United Marketing, Don Garber is the CEO of Soccer United Marketing. It is a second company outside of Major League Soccer that the owner-operators own. So they own, when you buy into Major League Soccer, you're buying into two companies, and you're getting shares in both. And so when we're talking about some, and that's just the abbreviation for Soccer United Marketing, when we're talking about some, what we're actually talking about is a company owned by the MLS owner operators that have a contract with the federation. So regardless of whether you are, a team in the NPSL, UPSL, USL, maybe you're just a local, youth club or whatever, you don't have access to that kind of influence. That influence has basically been, given exclusivity to Major League Soccer. So when we really talk about some, we're actually talking about Major League Soccer, that MLS is in fact the one getting the TV deals, making money off the TV deals. They make money off the U.S. women's national team. They make money off the U.S. men's national team. They make money off of the Mexican national teams. Major League Soccer is the one making that money through their second company called SUM, Soccer United Marketing. And so that's why it's such a problem that you have not only that contract, but as you have talked about, you have the CEO of Soccer United Marketing and the commissioner of Major League Soccer on your board of directors having influence over decisions. And we all know this, regardless of what's on paper about not being in the room when a decision is made. When you are in a position like being a board member of U.S. Soccer, And I've been to enough events where I've seen U.S. soccer leadership. Don Garber is right in the thick of it. He is not just a peripheral, board member. He is, you know, fully involved. So to think that, okay, well, he walked out of the room when they were negotiating a contract and had no influence on what was going on in the room before and after, is ridiculous. And no one should, take that lightly. I mean, his influence and Soccer United Marketing's influence is that intertwined. And in from my view, and I think from what I'm hearing from your view, is that detrimental on U.S. soccer and American soccer at large. When we look at this country, one of the things I often talk about is I think we should strive to be the greatest soccer country on earth, that our mission statement isn't actually big enough, that we should try to dream big and work even harder to build the greatest soccer country on earth. I think we have all the resources. I think we have all the potential in the world to become that soccer country that is at the top of the heap on the men's, the women's side, all of our programming, to be honest. When you look at the landscape of American soccer and you look at this country at large, what do you see as the potential of soccer in this country if it was fully unleashed?
Well, I think that's the billion-dollar question right there. And the issue is, are we an open country to unlimited investment in soccer, or are we in a closed country where investment in soccer is managed, regulated, monopolized by a small few number of people? And I think we're much more towards that monopolistic version or vision of soccer in America. And when you have essentially a monopoly at the top of the heap, it means that you have lower amounts of opportunity. And I'll just give an example of, and this is by far not just a soccer thing in America. This is a sports in America thing. Our sporting model in the United States of America is very closed model, top heavy, major metropolitan markets only, and the rest of the country is ignored, where the rest of the world is in many ways much less freedom oriented than the United States is culturally. They have a much more open free market type of, if you have sporting accomplishments and sporting merit, you can rise up the pyramid and eventually get all the way up to the top. It doesn't matter if you didn't have a $1 billion net worth owner by your team, you can get to the next level through sporting merit and how well you perform on the field. So I think that this is the biggest sports question of this century, is how are we going to move from the major metropolitan dominated model in the United States? I'll just give a crazy statistic, is two statistics. There are 23 states in the United States that do not have a top tier professional sports team. And that's NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and MLS. 135 out of 136 teams are concentrated in those top 50 markets in the United States. So that means that there is a huge swath of America that's being underserved when it comes to professional sports. There's 160 million people outside of those big 50 markets. It's just a tremendous opportunity. And if soccer wants to become the preeminent sport in the United States of America, I think that really it just needs to adopt the practices that are adopted in almost everywhere else in the world, and having an open system where you can have small communities work their way up the pyramid and eventually play on the biggest stages in the world. That's something that we don't have. And that connection is something that is incredibly valuable that is not being seen at the professional level. And so some people, I've raised this open model idea to folks, and they're like, well, it's understandable. You want to be in the biggest markets because you have the most amount of consumers, and those small teams would, from smaller states and smaller places, would never be able to compete on the biggest stage. But if you actually look at college sports, some of the best teams come from states that have no top tier professional sports teams. You look at the NCAA football championship, the BCS championship this year. You had Alabama versus Clemson, which had dominated the last decade in college football. They come from two states that have zero professional sports teams, Alabama and South Carolina. Virginia, which is kind of an anomaly because it's sort of a big state, but it doesn't have any big professional sports teams. They won the basketball championship last year. And so here we have people saying that professional sports will never succeed in these small markets all across America that have been completely underserved, monopolistic sports model, are just bursting at the seams, waiting to explode into something enormous, more enormous than we've ever seen in the United States of America before. And we see the evidence at the college level by smaller markets and smaller states able to get to the top of the heap because they have more of an open system, not a perfect system, but it's more of an open system where people from all across the country can compete and make it up to the top level. It's something that U.S. soccer should be looking into. They are sanctioning closed leagues. Why aren't they trying to sanction and establish open leagues? That should be the goal of U.S. soccer, is serve the entire country, not just specifically the top 50 markets in the United States of America. Their professional standards for leagues is geared towards this model, which is competing with these other established sports leagues in the United States on their terms, instead of inventing a new way for the United States of America's purposes and trying to get to all these underserved areas all across the country and giving them the unified vision that anyone, anywhere has unlimited opportunity and can make it to the top. That's what U.S. soccer should be going after.
When you note that you have 135 of 136 professional teams in America are in the top 50 markets, what is the one team that is not in a top 50 market?
It's the Green Bay Packers of the NFL. And I think that since they're a big rival of the Chicago Bears, I know a little bit about the Green Bay Packers. They've been around. Basically, the only reason why they're around is because they're over 90 years old. And so they come from a bygone era of the NFL, which was more regional in the Midwest. But they've won championships into the 2000s. They have shown on this big stage that they can compete with the best teams from across America. They can win championships. They're in a smaller market. I think that they have something like 320,000 people. When we talk about the big 50 markets in the United States, they're all over a million. So there's lots of these significantly large metropolitan areas between 1 million and 100,000 that I think would be totally viable. You know, if you look at the Green Bay Packers and their economic success, they're also interesting because they're fan-owned. It's one of the only professional sports teams in the United States that's fan-owned. They show a different way, and it gives me hope that a different way could be successful all across America, despite what the experts are telling us, that professional sports could only happen in big cities. But let me ask you this question. Sports is essentially entertainment. Are there only movie theaters in metropolitan areas with over a million people? Do artists, musicians only play in those big cities, or do they play in little cities too? Are there movie theaters in other cities too? Does McDonald's have stores in places other than big cities? There's this huge market opportunity for soccer, and it's naturally ingrained in the soccer culture already internationally. A huge opportunity. I think it's the pathway to go from being the fifth biggest sport in America to being the top sport in America by not ignoring the places that are being ignored by the big five professional leagues.
When we talk about, you know, the size of cities, one of the things that has gone on in the Premier League for the last few years, and that will change this year as Aston Villa it got promoted back to the Premier League in the promotion playoff. But for the last few years, the second largest city in England have not had a team in the Premier League. Both Birmingham City and Aston Villa were playing in the Championship. They have now, you know, gotten promoted and are, you know, going to be back in the Premier League starting in August. But when you look at these leagues in Europe and not just in England, but all over Europe, I think about Bournemouth in the Premier League. I think about Eibar in Spain. You know, Eibar in Villarreal are both from cities of less than 100,000 people, and play, mm-hmm. you know, in La Liga, the top league in Spain. Yet when we look at, you know, America, we go, well, look, if you don't have over a million people, we're not really interested in even having a conversation with you about a team. I just see a massive disconnect between what is perceived to be necessary to be professional or first division professional versus real world examples of what is taking place. I mean, Apple, one of the greatest companies in the world, was founded in a garage. And you know, and yet we think that the only way to bake a soccer team and make it successful is to throw it in the oven of $1 million city. Not $1 million, but a million people city, rather than, you know, as you brought up, and I have, you know, a deep knowledge of, you know, Alabama. I mean, the stadium holds over 100,000 people, and it sells out. It's packed for game days. You know, Major League Soccer isn't enjoying that kind of attendance at any location, and even their largest attendance, Atlanta United, pales in comparison to by 25-30% what Alabama will get for a game day in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which is nowhere near that list of million people cities. And the same goes across this country with other places. I think you bring up a really valid point there in terms of what should matter. And when we look at the U.S. soccer professional league standards, they are the rules that govern first, second, third division. And you have to keep in mind that those rules are another piece of the transparency and governance conversation we've been having today, that basically give Major League Soccer the ability to run alone in the first division, and they get to kind of have influence over how those rules are written and how it basically keeps their competition at bay. And the rules in that first division are all predicated on ownership, net worth, population of a city, of a metro market, city size, time zones, etc. None of that has anything to do with putting a quality product on the field, of knowing the business you're in, the soccer business, of developing players, of understanding and operating with excellence as an organization. None of that has any bearing on an organization's ability to run a first-rate club. It's all predicated on what I call arbitrary standards of net worth and in city location and city size rather than the quality of the club. And that's why we miss out on some of these incredible stories like Bournemouth and Ibar and Villarreal and others who you know, have written their own history and have done incredible things on the field without a merit-based system. They are locked out. If they were in America, they would never get a whiff. If you're mm-hmm. a city of 30,000 people, you're never getting a whiff of making it to the top. But the town that I grew up in is roughly the size of Ibar, playing in the first division in Spain. And to just put this in perspective, in the American perspective, the town that I grew up in the last few years has had from the same high school, six players in the NFL. Six players from one high school, one town, the size of Ibar that's playing in the top division in Spain. And so this idea that we can't find and develop talent and we can't build excellent clubs unless we're in a market of over a million, unless we have an owner that's a, you know, a billionaire, and it's only the ownership structure is constructed, you know, in one way that U.S. soccer likes, or a certain time zone, etc. It to me is just indisputable that those rules have very little to do with the product on the field and the game itself, and has all to do with protecting assets and control of the federation and access to the top levels of American soccer. When you look at the landscape of American soccer, and you look at where we are as a country, I want to ask you this one final question. If you were in charge of American soccer for a day, you have complete power. What would you do with your one day in charge?
Oh, my goodness. That's a great question. And thank you for having me on the show, Daniel. I really appreciate it. I would institute an open system. And I think that the appropriate organization, it should have been done a long time ago by U.S. Soccer. And I would allow anyone in the country to be able to invest and aspire to the top of U.S. Soccer, top of the nation. I think that we can have thousands of clubs. And it's not just that we would have more opportunity in some of those smaller metropolitan areas, but really, you would have more opportunities in the big markets as well. If you look at a place like London, and they have teams all up and down the pyramid, and they have, you know, one of the teams that I've been following, this is more in Manchester, but Salford City, that they've risen up like four or five tiers in just the last half a decade. Incredibly, like in London, you have Millwall, Crystal Palace, Oriented, Tottenham Hotspur, some of the bigger teams that you're familiar with, Chelsea, Fulham, Millwall. The opportunities are going to be orders of magnitude larger if we had an open system within the United States. Instead of subsidizing a closed system, we should be establishing and growing an open system where anybody from any community across the country can get together, a group of their friends, and start building something greater and aspire to that top level. That would be a transformational change, not just in U.S. soccer. I think that we would become the greatest soccer nation in the world if we just had an open system, an organized open system that allowed everyone to aspire to reach the top and be connected through a pyramid that made sense, instead of the system that we currently have, where everything's based on artificial scarcity. We're going to restrict who can make it to the top level. If you don't have $150 million to pay us, another $200-300 million to build a stadium, etc., we don't want anything to do with you. You see this on level after level in U.S. soccer, whether it be coaching licenses. There's artificial scarcity created by U.S. soccer to prevent people from getting licenses to be a coach. It should be the other way around. We should be sharing educational tools with as many people as possible and allowing every single state association to offer coaching licenses. But instead, we have this very restrictive model that restricts the amount of teams that can aspire or communities that can aspire to the very top, restricts the number of coaches that can aspire to the very top, you know, all the way up and down the line. We have a model built on closeness and monopolies. And if we had an open system, I think it would transform not just soccer, but all of the sports. I think all the other sports after a decade or two would change their models as well. But soccer has an opportunity here. We have the culture already within soccer fans across the nation. If we adopted an open model, that would be the one thing. I would want to do 100 things, but the one thing that I think that would have the most impact was to have an open system in the United States of America.
Well, I agree with you completely, and I hope and work every day to see that happen. And I know that you want to see that happen, and you know, we can only hope and continue to work towards those efforts. Brian, thanks for coming on the show. We really do appreciate you spending some time with us on this 4th of July. I don't think we could have talked about a better topic today than freedom for every American club to have the opportunity to rise on merit. There's no better theme than that of today. So thank you for spending some time with us. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Daniel. And I hope that Independence Day for U.S. soccer comes sometime soon.
You and me both. You and me both. Thank you. Thank you for that. Today's sponsor for this half hour is Charity Water. You can learn more about Charity Water at charitywater.org. They provide clean drinking water to people all over the world, and you can be a part of that story by going to charitywater.org. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Or you could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
I'd like to thank Brian for coming on the show today, this July 4th Independence Day. Enjoy it, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Sunday's going to be a big day, and we will cover that tomorrow, get in depth into both of those finals for the U.S. women's and men's national teams. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the day. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.